Iran calls on the International Atomic Energy Agency to clearly and unconditionally condemn the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Total number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. surpasses 14 million and with over 275,000 deaths amid a record number of hospitalizations. And OPEC members strike a deal with their allies to increase oil production over the coming months, but by less than anticipated in their previous report. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's envoy to the Vienna-based international organizations has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to clearly and unconditionally condemn the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. In a letter to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi said there is clear evidence showing Israel's involvement in acts of terrorism. He said this act of terrorism, that is. He said the act is obvious terrorism carried out with the aim of jeopardizing international peace and security and bringing instability to the region. Gharibabadi noted recent assassination is a continuation of a series of terror attacks against Iranian scientists, which started a decade back. Iran's envoy called on the international community to fulfill its obligations in fighting terrorism and condemning inhumane actions. Fakhrizadeh's assassination has drawn condemnations from many world leaders and countries. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has called on Western powers to condemn Fakhrizadeh's assassination as well and effectively support the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He made the remarks in an address to the sixth edition of the International Meeting of the Mediterranean Dialogue, known as MED, held by Italy. Max Civilli has your details.
Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Javad Zarif, attended the sixth edition of the Rome-MED Mediterranean Dialogues Conference, which is being held in a digital format from November 25 to December 4. This year, the initiative, promoted by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and by ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, has been focused on the topic Beyond COVID-19, Navigating Solutions for Post-Pandemic Times, featuring over 100 experts and political leaders. In his address, Zarif touched upon a number of issues of international relevance, spurred on by questions from Elie Gerenmayer from the European Council of Foreign Relations and Paolo Magri, Executive Vice President of ISPI, the top diplomat opened with an update on the coronavirus crisis in Iran.
The situation in Iran is pretty bad. Unfortunately, we're suffering from something more than the rest of the world is, and that is an economic war. This is way beyond restrictions. The United States even prevents us from using our own money in different countries to pay COVAX for the vaccine. If they say otherwise, they're simply lying.
Later, the discussion shifted on the nuclear deal signed in Vienna in 2015.
Earlier this week, some of Europe's leading diplomats urged the members of the E3, France, Germany and the UK, to act quickly to set out a roadmap for Iran and the US to return to compliance with the JCPOA. There's a real risk, experts say, that the efforts can be disrupted by those forces who have been working hard to escalate tensions between Tehran and Washington.
The Europeans have not been able to implement their part of the deal. The Europeans say that we are in full compliance. They're simply not. Implementation compliance means that they have to have effects for these actions. And we don't see an effect. We don't see any European company in Iran. We do not see any European country buying oil from Iran.
Zarif also commented on the assassination in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran of prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The future of the Iran nuclear deal will also be discussed with the European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs Josep Borrell on Friday, the final day of the conference. Max Civilli, Rome.
Now, a number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S. has passed the grim milestone of 14 million. Texas, California, and Florida are top three states with the highest numbers of infections, as the country reports a record high number of daily hospitalizations at over 100,000. The U.S. remains the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic, with over 275,000 deaths. Meanwhile, in Brazil, more than 50,000 new cases and 755 new deaths were reported just Thursday alone. South American country has registered some 6.5 million cases with over 175,000 deaths since the pandemic began. Now, COVID-19 is also surging throughout Europe, with several countries reporting a steep rise in infections and deaths there as well. The UK reported nearly 15,000 new infections on Thursday, with 414 more deaths. This brings the death toll there to over 60,000, which remains Europe's worst affected country in terms of fatalities. Italy also reported a record 993 deaths on the past day, while over 23,000 more people were confirmed to have contracted the disease. In Germany, officials have extended restrictions to curb spread of the virus.
Meine Damen und Herren, die Lage bleibt weiterhin sehr angespannt.
The situation remains very tense. We were able to stabilize the number of cases in recent weeks, and this is the first success which I would like to underline. However, without the restriction measures, the situation would be much worse. Too many people are still getting infected with the SARS-CoV-2. The number of cases is still too high.
The number of new cases and deaths in Germany is also on the increase. According to the Robert Koch Institute, COVID-19 cases in the country have increased by 22,000 to surpass 1.1 million. Germany also reported 480 new deaths, raising its total to over 17,000. In Switzerland, the health minister there called the COVID-19 situation very worrying, as infection levels have stabilized at a very high level. He warned the country may need to tighten its restrictions. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, including Russia, have reached an accord to boost output from January, but by less than agreed in a previous agreement. In a statement, the Kazakh energy minister said, a group known as OPEC Plus accepted to raise output by only 500,000 barrels a day instead of the 1.9 million entailed in the previous accord. Members also agreed to meet monthly to decide whether to further adjust output. A deal came at the end of a video conference of countries in the OPEC Plus Club. Group is currently cutting its production by 7.7 million barrels a day. Curbs are being implemented to prop up oil prices and counter weak demand due to the coronavirus pandemic. Time is running out for the European Union and Britain to reach a post-Brexit trade deal, with significant differences remaining between the two sides. We discuss the issue in length in our news review program. Here it is. European diplomats have cast doubt over a post-Brexit trade deal with the UK, citing significant divergences between the two sides. A member of the EU negotiation team said London and Brussels are working hard to try to overcome the gaps, but final outcome of negotiations is still uncertain. A separately, European diplomat warned that there will be no more concessions in trade talks with Britain. He said the bloc's negotiators have moved to, quote, within millimeters of the limits of their mandate at the talks. A diplomat stressed that it is now up to London to compromise if a deal is to be reached. And now joining us for the program is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol, and Rodney Shakespeare, professor of binary economics, joining us from London. Gentlemen, nice to have you both on. Welcome to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Professor Shakespeare. Your initial thoughts on where we stand today. We've got about 27 or 28 days left before this transition period is to expire. What do you expect we'll see?
A few weeks ago, Dominic Cummings was ejected from Downing Street. And I think that's probably a sign that the British government is starting to be more accommodating with Europe and probably attempting to make an agreement. My feeling is that there will be an attempt at agreement. It will be a very weak agreement, with certain parts of it still to be decided. That does not mean that any agreement will be approved by the other heads of government or by the European Parliament. We must never forget that the Americans will have a say in this, and that any move in the UK to end the Good Friday Agreement between North and South, the two parts of the island, of Ireland, will also be a factor in it. So there you are. I think it's moving towards some sort of agreement, but a very, very weak one. And all the big issues are still lying there underneath. If there is an agreement, the hardline Brexiteers are going to be the ones who are going to be upset, because basically they want to leave the EU and then have no means by which anybody can stop us lowering employment standards, lowering environmental standards, lowering consumer standards. They just simply want to have a sort of free trade, low wage economy. So I think something will happen, but it'll be very weak.
Thank you, Professor. And Tony, welcome to the program. Do you share that optimism that something, possibly a weak deal, may take shape in the next couple of weeks?
Well, look, this is a very important deal, isn't it? Because when Britain joined the EEC, before the whole idea of a political union was sneaked upon the public, and there was never any proper vote about that. There was in some countries, but not here. We were all just told to accept it. Britain was actually a very much more powerful industrial nation. We've seen our industries go, but more importantly, the British had a great deal of fishing rights all around, actually around the North Sea, down the Channel, actually much more than they've had, obviously, since they've joined the EEC and the European Union. So there's a great deal of discussion going on about these things. I honestly don't think that the EU in Brussels can afford to give Britain any kind of deal, because they know that other European countries are going to be looking at what deal Britain gets, and they'll be expecting to get something similar if they decide to leave. And it's, the whole point here is to dissuade other countries, and in fact it's the populations in those countries, because the political leaders in other countries, apart from possibly in Hungary and Poland, are already decided that they are wedded to Brussels, because there's a gravy train in Brussels where they know that a senior politician in Germany or France, Spain, anywhere else like that, if they get ousted by their population, their public, then they will find themselves magically spirited into Brussels to become an EU commissioner. So they'll be running the whole show, even though their public has rejected them. That's how perverse I think the EU system works. Or doesn't work, and of course it hasn't been working with the financial crises, the migrant crises. I mean, you know, you can name one after the other loads of problems that the that Brussels and the EU have had. But look, coming down to the line as we're doing at the end of December was always going to be problematic, and the EU, I don't think, is going to give Britain any kind of deal, even the Canada deal that David Davis and other negotiators, although he's not actually directly negotiating, he's behind the scenes because he's a former Brexit secretary, at least a negotiator for Brexit in the past. They are saying that they're going to get a bad deal, and they want a Canada deal, but they're not going to be even given that. That's the same deal as we've got with Canada. This is the obvious thing to say. Sorry, in order to get the EU to agree to something. The Canada deal is the thing to get. It's obvious it's already been agreed. And so that's peculiar that the EU don't want to agree to that. The answer, I think, is because we've got an EU that knows that it can't give Britain a deal. So they are kind of almost been wasting their time maybe doing some of these negotiations. I don't think there'll be a deal. And that's the way that Brussels is going to, I think, punish Britain when it comes to the end of December.
Interesting. And you hear France and the Netherlands kind of taking that same hard line and pessimistic approach to this whole thing. Now, Professor Shakespeare, my second question to you, sir. From the time that we saw the referendum on Brexit until current day, how have you seen sentiments, if they've changed at all? To what extent have people throughout the UK, citizens, changed sentiments with respect to how they view Brexit? You know, if they supported it, they still do, or the ones that don't, have they changed sides or whatnot?
Well, there's no doubt that people wanted to get the thing settled. But of course, this is a massive thing with much detail. And my feeling is that there has been a sort of shift back to some sort of deal, a very tenuous deal, because people recognize is that roughly half our trade goes to and from Europe. And under world trade rules, there'll be some tariffs. And certain industries like cars or, say, agriculture, the tariffs could be much higher.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both. Do stay safe until we see both of you again. That's Tony Gosling there joining us from Bristol and Rodney Shakespeare joining us out of London. And that's a wrap for this segment of Europe News Review. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye for now. Now, stocks in the U.S. continue to be disconnected from the real economy of the American people. November was a record month for Wall Street, even as increased coronavirus lockdowns continued economic despair of the lower classes. Rami Mazahiri has your story from Chicago.
The unequal gap between America's rich and poor keeps widening at a record pace. Last month was the best November ever for stocks. Yet across Main Street, a once-in-a-century economic depression is being widely documented. While about half of U.S. retirees do rely on a 401k plan, which includes some stock ownership, the richest 10% of Americans own nearly 90% of all stocks. Since the start of the coronavirus lockdowns, the top 10 U.S. billionaires have now increased their wealth by 42%, or $127 billion. That 8-month increase is greater than the annual GDP of more than 130 nations. As much as the nation's ongoing police brutality problems or current presidential election confusion, economic inequality has been a major driver of this year's unprecedented political protest.
We had to fight for an 8-hour workday, and that involved people dying, violence in the street, for that to happen. And it happened here in Chicago, of all places. The history of unions have been fighting for working people, and not just the people who are in unions, but working people of all historical backgrounds. That means civil rights, that means women's movements, and that also means improving the quality of our lives on an economic basis.
Data this week from the Workers Union-linked Economic Policy Institute revealed that from 1979 to 2019, the income of the richest 0.1% has risen 345%. Over that same time period, the lower 90% of society has only seen a 26% increase, which is not close to covering the accumulated inflation. Since 1979, so-called trickle-down or neoliberal economics, which prioritizes corporations, slashes the role of government, and neuters the power of workers' unions, has completely dominated the nation's two-party system.
In the neoliberal era, you've had two parties that have been advocates of big business with a very different subtle change on like social ideas and how quickly they act on big business. You know, there might be a more the Democrats might be more subtle of their attacks on working people than the Republicans, but still there, right?
In 2019, the United States had the worst income inequality among not just all very developed nations, but across the entire West, excepting only Bulgaria. The economic catastrophe of 2020 will push the world's richest nation even further down that list. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A 7,000-acre wildfire has forced thousands to flee their homes after breaking out throughout Southern California. Authorities have urged people to shelter in hotels or with friends or family, as there are no public shelters being arranged because of the coronavirus. Southern California utility services have been cut power to over tens of thousands of customers to reduce the risks of sparking new fires. The blaze called the Bonfire was sparked from a house in Santiago Canyon in Orange County. It quickly spread into brush and then exploded into a wildfire due to gusty winds in the area. About 500 firefighters are working to try to contain this inferno. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S. military-industrial complex is returning to its roots as the CIA turns to big tech to maintain control and rebuild the war economy, says Raul Diego Reiter in an article published under the heading CIA Partners with Google, Amazon, and IBM in Latest Big Tech Procurement Drive. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The vaunted 17 intelligence agencies that comprise the U.S. Intel community will be sharing a network of private sector cloud computing service providers, which includes Microsoft, Google, Oracle, IBM, and Amazon Web Services, AWS, as part of a 15-year contract said to be worth tens of billions of dollars. AWS currently holds the sole contract to provide cloud computing services to a number of intelligence agencies, including the FBI and the NSA. That contract is set to expire in 2023, and this new award managed by the CIA will further weaken Amazon's once privileged position in the federal money sweepstakes, which had already taken a hard hit when Microsoft was unexpectedly chosen over Bezos' company for the Department of Defense-owned cloud services contract for the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure, JEDI, program. The Central Intelligence Agency will take full advantage of its access to money without oversight to disburse the government funds at the agency's discretion. Although speculated to rise into tens of billions, the CIA has no plans to disclose the real value of the C2E contracts. The Commercial Cloud Enterprise C2E procurement program was unveiled in February by the premier U.S. spy agency in a bid to establish a cloud computing service platform for the country's intelligence agencies separate from JEDI, which remains enmeshed in a protracted legal contest with AWS and is 2 years behind implementation. The five tech giants will compete with each other for task orders that come in from the multitude of intelligence agencies throughout the U.S. and will span every security clearance level up to and including top secret clearance. The contract calls for the building of infrastructure and all other basic cloud services, as well as professional services and public-facing services. Many seem surprised by the multi-contractor ad hoc nature of the C2E awards because it appears not to settle on a particular cloud provider. And while these dynamics do stray from the relatively recent trend of sole contract awards and tacit monopolies many corporations have enjoyed through similar public-private partnership, this particular practice of pitting contractors against each other for services requisitioned by the government is not new. In fact, such practices are an intrinsic part of the military-industrial complex and its historical origins at the height of the British Empire. The start of the Glorious Revolution in 1688 marked the beginning of 125 years of constant war for the global superpower of the day, and the slow but inexorable rise of an industry of war made up exclusively of freelancers who would make the guns, rifles, and bullets their bloodthirsty queen required. As the empire grew, the processes for the production of weapons underwent a dramatic change from artisanal modes to full-fledged factory-style production, all spared by the biggest army and navy in the world, which was pillaging and extracting resources to fuel the burgeoning enterprise of capitalism. This period also fine-tuned the relationship between the state and independent contractors, with the former establishing laws governing them in order to leverage their overwhelming advantage. Other strategies were also employed to both suppress the price the crown paid for material and to make sure that no single contractor held too big a stake in the supply chain. In her book, Empire of Guns, Priya Satya details this entire process and destroys the myth that the Industrial Revolution was the result of a cotton-picking machine, when even a cursory look at the history shows that it was guns and a state engaged in perpetual war that laid the foundations of our current economic paradigm. Now we stand on the threshold of the so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution in a world that has perfected weapons of war to atomic levels. New cyber weapons are being forged, and it is only fitting that the war industry, led today by the United States of America, would return to its origins to maintain its own monopoly on human suffering and devastation in the name of profit. The public-private partnership has been another significant trend that also mirrors a trend in Victorian England. But in today's world, a parallel legal system has grown alongside the state's war industry and is also now at the disposal of the corporations who wish to dispute any deal, leading to considerable delays in the execution of contracts. Cases like JEDI suit affect the military readiness goals of the national security state if it cannot move forward with a particular initiative due to litigation. Another recent case is holding up the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency CISA efforts to centralize inflow and outflow of data regarding cyber threats. In October, the Government Services Agency GSA awarded a $13 million contract to a company called NDynA to create a centralized database that agencies can use to report, discover, and take actions against cyber threat information. A much larger competitor, HackerOne, filed a protest questioning the award on grounds of failure to meet eligibility requirements and the smaller company's competence to carry out the work. Technicalities like these can hold up a project in court for years, so it makes perfect sense for the state-run war industry to return to its roots and apply the tried and true principles of divide and conquer against the people, making their guns, whether real or virtual. By taking the first few spots on the big tech pecking order and putting them in a room to duke out for a government contract, the war establishment is recognizing the growing power of these firms and is unleashing the CIA to curb it and diminish threats to supply chain of the 21st century's permanent war economy.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام وقد سأله رجل من علماء أهل الشام فالشيء خلقه من شيء أو من لا شيء خلق الشيء لا من شيء كان قبله ولو خلق الشيء من شيء إذن لم يكن له انقطاع أبدا ولم يزل الله إذن ومعه شيء ولكن كان الله ولا شيء معه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was asked by a scholar from Damascus, "So, the thing, did Allah create it from something else or from nothing?" Imam al-Baqir replied, "Allah created a thing whereby nothing existed before it. Were He to have created from something, then there would be infinite regress, and there would always have been something existing alongside Allah, when in actual fact, Allah existed when nothing else was in existence."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In one of these very excellent and golden conversations in the history of Islam, and specifically in the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, is this conversation that Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, has with his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. Now, this conversation is a very long conversation, which is full of great advice, great wisdom, this beautiful knowledge, high moral standards and ideals. Now, one of the things which was discussed in this conversation is as follows. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "However, you should compare yourself with Allah's book. If you follow its way, refrain from its prohibitions, wish for it to increase an interest for you and be afraid of its frightening. Then be steadfast and cheerful. If you are dissenting to the Quran, then taking account of yourself should never deceive you. So, dear brothers and sisters, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says that we should compare ourselves with the Holy Quran. We should follow the path that the Holy Quran has shown us. We should also refrain from the things that the Holy Quran has prohibited us from. And we should also do dua, we should do supplication, we should request Allah to help increase an interest in the Quran in our heart. And we should be afraid when the Holy Quran frightens us, for example, from the punishments of the hereafter. If we are doing these things, then we should remain steadfast upon these things and we should be cheerful that we are upon the right path. Beautiful words given to us in this conversation between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, a student of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and Imam Baqir alayhi salam himself. Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. And so I would like to talk a little bit about the historical conditions that surrounded this great Imam and see what lessons we can learn from him and in the struggles that he had to face. And the time of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was characterized by many of these types of questions under which this idea of khilafat or rulership should fall. Incidentally, our Sunni brothers talk about the fact, they say the fact, the so-called fact, that the Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, never selected a successor to him. And he left it up to the community to do so. And we say that it is only in the wisdom of the Prophet for him to do so. And this proves our point, because we see the amount of chaos and killing and murder and wrong treatment coming out of this whole issue of the Khilafat. One of the Shia factions that came to the Imam, to Imam al-Baqir, for support was Mukhtar. Mukhtar, who was leading a revolt against the Umayyads. The Imam did not give him that support, and he turned around and went to Muhammad ibn Hanafiya. Muhammad ibn Hanafiya is the son of Imam Ali alayhi salam, but from another person, another wife, a Hanafiya wife, who, by being silent on Mukhtar's selection, gave, in a sense, tacit approval for him to use his name. And so Mukhtar, in the name of Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, led a revolt, and in that revolt exacted vengeance on many of the killers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Nevertheless, it is very significant that the Shia were at this point willing and able to choose Muhammad ibn Hanafiya as their imam. So one of the things that was very significant here is that the Shia, the idea of imamat and the legitimacy of imamat, how do you legitimize an imam? How do you identify an imam? This was a very important question that needed to be clarified.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Rudolph Giuliani, who's promoting baseless claims of widespread election fraud, talked about a pardon with President Trump as recently as last week. President Trump has discussed with advisors whether to grant preemptive pardons to his children and to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and to his personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. Trump talked with Giuliani about pardoning him as recently as last week, according to two people briefed on the matter. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnists Maggie Haberman and Michael Schmidt. The piece is titled, Trump has discussed with advisors pardons for his three eldest children and Giuliani. Stay with us for more of Maggie Haberman and Michael Schmidt's article. Rudolph Giuliani, who is promoting baseless claims of widespread election fraud, talked about a pardon with President Trump as recently as last week. President Trump has discussed with advisors whether to grant preemptive pardons to his children, to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and to his personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. Trump talked with Giuliani about pardoning him as recently as last week, according to two people briefed on the matter. President Trump has told others that he's concerned that a Biden Justice Department might seek retribution against the president by targeting the oldest three of his five children, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump, as well as Ivanka Trump's husband, Jared Kushner, a White House senior advisor has said. Donald Trump Jr. has been under investigation by Robert Mueller III, the special counsel, for contacts that the younger Mr. Trump had with Russians offering damaging information on Hillary Clinton during the 2016 presidential campaign. but he was never charged. Jared Kushner provided false information to federal authorities about his contacts with foreigners and Russians in particular for his security clearance, but was given one anyway by the president. The nature of Mr. Trump's concern about any potential criminal exposure of Eric Trump or Ivanka Trump is unclear, although an investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney into the Trump Organization has expanded to include tax write-offs on millions of dollars in consulting fees by the company, some of which appear to have gone to Ivanka Trump. Presidential pardons, however, do not provide protection against state or local crimes. Mr. Giuliani's potential criminal exposure is also unclear, although he was under investigation as recently as this summer by federal prosecutors in Manhattan for his business dealings in Ukraine and his role in ousting the American ambassador in Ukraine. The plot was at the heart of the impeachment of Donald Trump. The speculation about pardon activity at the White House is churning furiously, underscoring how much the Trump administration has been dominated by investigations and criminal prosecutions of people in the president's orbit. Donald Trump himself was singled out by federal prosecutors as individual number one in a court filing in the case that sent Michael Cohen, his former lawyer and fixer, to prison. The discussions between Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani occurred as the former New York mayor has become one of the loudest voices pushing baseless claims of widespread election fraud in the 2020 election, which Mr. Trump still proclaims publicly that he won. Many of Donald Trump's longtime aides have refused to do his bidding to try to overturn an election that President-elect Joseph Biden won by nearly 7 million votes. But Rudolph Giuliani has repeatedly thrust himself into the spotlight to cast doubt on the results of the election, which has ingratiated him with the president. ABC News reported earlier on Tuesday, 1st of December, that Donald Trump was considering pardoning his family members. The Fox News host and Trump ally Sean Hannity said on Monday, 30th of November, that given the animosity from Democrats directed at Mr. Trump, the president should consider pardoning his entire family. If Joe Biden ever became president, I'd tell Trump, pardon yourself and pardon your family, Sean Hannity told his viewers. Donald Trump is an avid consumer on Fox News, particularly of Sean Hannity's show. Such a broad pardon preempting any charge or conviction is highly unusual, but does have precedent. In the most famous example, President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for all of his actions as president. President George Washington pardoned plotters of the Whiskey Rebellion, shielding them from treason prosecutions. And President Jimmy Carter pardoned thousands of American men who illegally avoided the draft for the Vietnam War. Donald Trump has wielded his clemency powers liberally in cases that resonate with him personally, or for people who have a direct line to him through friends or family, whilst thousands of other cases await his review. Pardon for Rudy Giuliani is certain to prompt accusations that Donald Trump has used his pardon power to obstruct investigations and insulate himself and his allies. Andrew Weissman, a top prosecutor for Robert Mueller, has said that Donald Trump's dangling of pardon for his allies impeded their work. In July, the president commuted the sentence of his longtime advisor Roger Stone. who had refused to cooperate with the special counsel's investigators and was eventually convicted of 7 felonies. Last week, Donald Trump pardoned his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who had backed out of his cooperation agreement with the special counsel's office for any and all possible offenses beyond the charge that he had faced of lying to federal prosecutors. The Michael Flynn pardon raised expectations that President Trump would bestow clemency on other associates, like his former campaign chairman Paul Manafort, who refused to discuss matters from the 2016 presidential election with prosecutors in his final weeks in office. Mr. Giuliani has asked Donald Trump's campaign to pay him $20,000 a day for his work on trying to overturn the election, a figure that would make him among the most highly paid lawyers in the world. The staggering sum has stirred opposition among Donald Trump's aides, who worry that Mr. Giuliani has perpetuated the claims of election fraud in hope of making as much money as possible. Rudy Giuliani has expressed concern that any federal investigations of his conduct that appear to have been dormant under the Trump administration could be revived in a Biden administration, according to people who have spoken to him. Legal experts say that if Donald Trump wants to fully protect Rudolph Giuliani from prosecution after he leaves office, the president would most likely have to detail in the language of the pardon what crimes he believed Mr. Giuliani had committed. Federal prosecutors in Manhattan have since 2019 been investigating the role of Rudy Giuliani and 2 other associates in a wide-ranging pressure campaign directed at pushing the Ukrainian government to investigate Mr. Trump's rivals, namely Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. The 2 Giuliani associates, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, were arrested in October of 2019 as they prepared to board a flight from Washington to Frankfurt, Germany, with one-way tickets. They were charged with violating campaign finance laws as part of a complex scheme to undermine the former American ambassador in Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Trump believed should have been doing more to pressure the Ukrainians. Prosecutors in Manhattan continue to investigate Mr. Giuliani's role in the scheme over the past year, focusing on whether he was in pushing to oust Ms. Yovanovitch, America's ambassador to Kiev, essentially double-dipping, working not only for Mr. Trump, but also for Ukrainian officials who wanted the ambassador gone for their own reasons, according to people briefed on the matter. It is a federal crime to try to influence the United States government at the request or direction of a foreign official without disclosing their involvement. Rudolph Giuliani has said that he did nothing wrong and that he did not register as a foreign agent because he was acting on behalf of Donald Trump, not any Ukrainians. Even as Donald Trump maintains that the election was stolen and that he files lawsuits aimed at delaying its certification, his White House is preparing for the final stages of his presidency. The end of any administration typically prompts a wave of pardons, particularly when a term has been engulfed in controversy, like Donald Trump's, in which several people close to him became ensnared in federal investigations. The pardon power has been used by many presidents in politically self-serving ways, whether it was George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton, said Jack Goldsmith, a professor at Harvard Law School, citing how Mr. Bush pardoned 6 of his associates, including the former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, for their role in the Iran-Contra affair. Politically, a pardon of Rudolph Giuliani would be explosive, Mr. Goldsmith added, but pardoning pals has been done before. Under previous administrations, presidents have largely granted pardons after they have gone through a formal review process at the Justice Department, where lawyers examine the convictions, discuss the ramifications of a potential pardon with prosecutors, and then provided the White House with recommendations on how to proceed. On several occasions, Donald Trump has gone against the Justice Department's recommendations and the advice of his own White House advisors, granting pardons to political allies and to celebrities. When presidents have deviated from that process, scandals have occasionally occurred, especially after pardons in the last days of an administration. On the final day of Bill Clinton's presidency, he granted a pardon to Mark Rich, a wealthy financier and longtime Democratic donor, who was considered a fugitive as he fled the United States to avoid paying taxes. Prosecutors in Manhattan investigated whether the pardon had been part of a quid pro quo, but no one was ever charged. At the time, Rudolph Giuliani, who had helped bring criminal charges against Mark Rich years earlier as a federal prosecutor, was deeply critical of the move, calling it a disgrace and declaring it a midnight pardon. No president has tried to grant someone a pardon for crimes they have not yet committed, essentially a prospective get-out-of-jail-free card, and legal experts say it is unlikely to hold any weight. In the case of Donald Trump Jr., Robert Mueller's investigation examined questions of whether his contacts during the 2016 presidential election with WikiLeaks and Russians offered dirt on Hillary Clinton amounted to campaign finance violations. Donald Trump Jr. was never interviewed by the special counsel's office and was never charged. In the case of Jared Kushner, he omitted several significant contacts with foreigners when he filed out a form for his White House security clearance, including ones with the Russians offering damaging information on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. Under federal law, it is a crime to provide inaccurate or incomplete information on the background check documents for security clearances. In 2018, the White House counsel and chief of staff recommended that Jared Kushner not receive a top security clearance because of issues that had been discovered during his background check. Over the objections of Mr. Trump's aides, the president unilaterally granted Jared Kushner the security clearance.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.